real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.
Christmas Eve, 2002, Modesto, California. A 27-year-old woman, 8 months pregnant, vanishes from her home. Her husband reports her missing that evening. He tells police she went for a walk with the dog and never came back. He seems calm, almost too calm. Within days, investigators discover he's been having an affair. He had told his mistress he lost his wife 2 weeks before she actually disappeared. He had said this would be his first Christmas without her, 2 weeks before she went missing. When reporters ask him about his wife, he uses past tense. Lacey was, not Lacey is. When volunteers search for her, he goes golfing. When her family holds vigils, he calls his mistress and lies about being in Paris. America looks at Scott Peterson and sees a man who killed his wife. 4 months later, Lacey Peterson's body washes ashore in San Francisco Bay, in the exact area where Scott said he had been fishing the day she disappeared. Her unborn son's body is found nearby. Scott is arrested with $15,000 in cash, dyed blonde hair, and camping gear. He's 30 miles from the Mexican border. The trial captivates the nation. The jury convicts. Scott Peterson is sentenced to death. Case closed. Except now, 22 years later, the Los Angeles Innocence Project says the case against Scott Peterson is built on a foundation of misread behavior, suppressed evidence, and a timeline that doesn't hold up to modern science. They say Lacey may have died days after Scott's alibi, that witnesses saw her alive after he left, that a burglary across the street involving men Lacey confronted was deliberately hidden by police, that a van with a bloody mattress was found burning nearby and never investigated. They say Scott Peterson might be innocent. So here's the question. Did Scott Peterson kill his pregnant wife and unborn son? Or did we convict a man based on how he looked, how he acted, and how we assumed he felt, rather than what we could actually prove? Intent doesn't lie. People do. But what if we misread his intent entirely? I'm Carmen Carrion, and this is Deadly Intent. Lacey Denise Rocha was born May 4, 1975, in Modesto, California. By all accounts, she was vibrant, outgoing, deeply loved. Her mother, Sharon Rocha, described her as someone who made people feel special. She was warm, thoughtful, the kind of friend who remembered birthdays and showed up with homemade cookies when you needed her. Scott Lee Peterson was born October 24, 1972, in San Diego, the youngest of seven children. Athletic, good-looking, charming in that effortless way some people are. He wasn't the type to show much emotion. Contained, controlled. The kind of guy who smiled easily, but didn't let you see beneath the surface. They met in 1994 at a cafe in Morro Bay, California, where Lacey was working. Friends described them as a solid couple. Affectionate, social, the kind of pair that seemed to fit together easily. Lacey brought warmth and energy. Scott brought stability and calm. They married December 9, 1997, honeymooned in Tahiti, and settled in Modesto near Lacey's family. Scott worked as a fertilizer salesman. Lacey worked at local restaurants before focusing on their home. They bought a modest house on Covina Avenue, got a golden retriever named Mackenzie, barbecued with neighbors, spent holidays with family. From the outside, they looked like the American dream. But by 2002, cracks were forming. Scott had grown restless. The marriage felt routine. Lacey wanted to settle down, start a family, build a life in Modesto. Scott wanted something else, something he couldn't articulate. In spring 2002, Lacey became pregnant. She was thrilled. She decorated the nursery in ocean themes, whales, sailboats, soft blues and greens. She talked about the baby constantly. The baby, a boy they planned to name Connor, was due February 10th, 2003. Scott seemed supportive outwardly. He helped set up the nursery, went to appointments, but people close to him said he seemed ambivalent, not hostile, just not as enthusiastic as Lacey. Friends noticed Scott seemed distant, distracted. His mind was somewhere else. In November 2002, just weeks before Lacey disappeared, Scott met Amber Frey. Amber was a massage therapist living in Fresno, 27 years old, a single mother. A mutual friend set them up. Scott told Amber he was single, never been married, looking for a serious relationship. They started dating, romantic dinners, weekend trips, long phone calls. On December 9th, 2002, Scott and Lacey's fifth wedding anniversary, Scott called Amber and told her something strange. He said he had lost his wife. He said this would be his first Christmas without her. He said the holidays were hard. Amber, who believed Scott was single, thought this was a reference to a past relationship. But Scott's phrasing was chilling. Lost his wife. Past tense. Like Lacey was already gone. This conversation happened on December 9th, 2002. Lacey Peterson disappeared 15 days later. Having an affair doesn't make you a murderer, but the affair becomes significant because of what Scott told Amber 2 weeks before Lacey vanished. The prosecution would argue this proved premeditation. Scott was already planning to kill Lacey, setting up his post-murder life, preparing Amber for the inevitable news. But there's an alternative. Scott was lying to avoid the truth. He was married with a pregnant wife at home, living a double life he knew couldn't last. So he told Amber he'd lost his wife, because he couldn't admit he was a cheater about to be a father, in way over his head. People lie to avoid consequences. They lie because the truth is too complicated, too damaging to their self-image. Once Lacey disappeared, that lie became devastating. It looked like foreshadowing, a confession hidden in plain sight. Same words, two completely different interpretations of intent. And the difference between those interpretations is the difference between life in prison and wrongful conviction.
Real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.
December 24th, 2002, Christmas Eve. Scott Peterson woke up that morning and told Lacey he was going fishing at the Berkeley Marina, about 90 miles north. It was unusual. Scott had never been much of a fisherman. He had only recently bought a small 14-foot aluminum boat and had never used it. According to Scott, Lacey planned to stay home, walk the dog, then go grocery shopping for the Christmas Eve dinner they were hosting for her family. Scott says he left between 9:30 and 10 a.m. He says Lacey was watching Martha Stewart, an episode about meringue. She was wearing black pants and a white top. She seemed fine, normal, happy. At 10:18 a.m., neighbor Karen Servas found the Petersons' golden retriever, Mackenzie, wandering alone in the street wearing a muddy leash. Karen recognized the dog, took Mackenzie back to the Petersons' house and put her in the backyard. This is critical. Mackenzie was found loose at 10:18 a.m. If Scott left between 9:30 and 10, and the dog was found at 10:18, that suggests Lacey did take the dog for a walk after Scott left, and something happened during that walk. Or it suggests Scott is lying about when he left. Scott says he drove to his warehouse briefly, then headed to Berkeley Marina. He went fishing for a few hours in bad weather. Didn't catch anything. He couldn't remember what kind of fish he was trying to catch. Couldn't remember what bait he used. Couldn't explain why he had driven 90 miles to fish in cold, drizzly weather when there were closer places. Scott returned home around 4:30 p.m. Lacey wasn't there. Her car was in the driveway, her purse inside, keys on the counter, house unlocked, Mackenzie in the backyard. Scott called Lacey's cell phone. No answer. He took a shower, did laundry, ate pizza. Then, around 5:15 p.m., he called Lacey's mother, Sharon Rocha. "Hi, Sharon. Is Lacey with you?" Sharon said no. She asked why. Scott told her he'd come home and Lacey wasn't there, probably at her mother's or shopping. Sharon immediately felt something was wrong. Lacey was 8 months pregnant, due in less than 6 weeks. She didn't just disappear without telling anyone. Sharon and her husband rushed to the Petersons' house. By 5:45 p.m., they were calling hospitals, calling Lacey's friends. By 6 p.m., they were searching the neighborhood. By 6:40 p.m., they called the police. The search began immediately, hundreds of volunteers combing the neighborhood. Nearby La Loma Park, where Lacey walked Mackenzie, surrounding areas. Flyers went up. The media picked up the story. A pregnant woman missing on Christmas Eve became national news within 24 hours. From the very beginning, police looked closely at Scott Peterson. Not because they had evidence, they didn't, but because something felt off. Scott's behavior was strange. He wasn't crying, wasn't visibly panicked. He seemed detached, controlled, almost irritated by the attention. When reporters interviewed him, he was calm, too calm. He spoke about Lacey in past tense. Lacey was instead of Lacey is. When volunteers organized search parties, Scott didn't join. He said he needed to stay by the phone. When Lacey's family held vigils, Scott showed up but seemed distant. He didn't comfort Sharon, didn't cry. He stood on the edges checking his phone. And then there was the affair. On December 30th, 2002, 6 days after Lacey disappeared, Amber Frey called the Modesto Police Department. She told them she'd been dating Scott Peterson, met him in November through a mutual friend. Scott told her he was single. They had been seeing each other for weeks, romantic, attentive, talking about a future. Then she saw him on the news, realized he wasn't single, he was married. His pregnant wife was missing. And he had told her he'd lost his wife 2 weeks before Lacey disappeared. Amber agreed to cooperate. She agreed to continue talking to Scott and record their conversations. Those recordings became some of the most damning evidence at trial. In one call, Scott is at a New Year's Eve vigil in Modesto, surrounded by hundreds of people holding candles, praying for Lacey's safe return. And he calls Amber and tells her he's in Paris, near the Eiffel Tower, watching fireworks. He's lying to her while standing at a vigil for his missing wife. In another call, Amber confronts him about being married. Scott stumbles through excuses that make no sense. He admits he wasn't truthful, says he should have told her about Lacey. But he never says he's sorry, never says he's worried about Lacey. He just tries to manage Amber's feelings so she won't leave. The recordings painted a picture of a man living a double life. A man who could lie effortlessly. A man who seemed more concerned about his mistress than his missing pregnant wife. More suspicious behavior emerged. Scott sold Lacey's car while she was still missing. He started remodeling the nursery, the room Lacey had lovingly decorated for Connor, and turned it into storage. He told people Lacey was missing. Not that he believed she'd been abducted or hurt, just missing, like she'd wandered off. He was seen vacuuming his truck at a car wash while volunteers searched. He went golfing, met with a real estate agent about selling the house. People who saw Scott during those weeks described him as eerily calm, unemotional, almost annoyed by the investigation and media circus. America looked at Scott Peterson and saw guilt. Here's where intent becomes almost impossible to read accurately. Because guilt and grief can look identical from the outside, so can guilt and fear, and guilt and emotional shutdown. If Scott killed Lacey, these behaviors make perfect sense. He wasn't grieving because he knew exactly where Lacey was. He'd put her there. He was calm because he knew she wasn't coming back. He remodeled the nursery because he didn't need it. He lied to Amber to preserve the new life he had killed to obtain. But there's an alternative interpretation. Scott was having an affair. When Lacey disappeared, he knew it would come out. He knew he'd look guilty. That knowledge alone would explain the behavior. Not because he killed her, but because he was terrified everyone would think he did. The fear of looking guilty produces the same behavior as actual guilt. And maybe he did feel guilty for being relieved that her and the baby were gone. Scott was emotionally shut down. Some people fall apart under stress. Some go numb. Some compartmentalize so completely they seem robotic. If Scott was experiencing trauma from guilt or genuine loss, his brain might have shut down emotional responses as survival. Scott sold Lacey's car and remodeled the nursery. Looks callous. Could also be avoidance. Someone who can't bear reminders, trying desperately to function by staying busy and removing triggers. Scott lied to Amber. Looks like a man preserving his affair at all costs. Could also be complete panic. Wife missing, he's the suspect. Affair about to destroy his life, scrambling to control any part of the narrative he still can. Juries expect grief to look a certain way. They expect tears, panic, visible breakdowns. When defendants don't perform grief as expected, juries read that as guilt. But psychological research shows people grieve very differently. Some cry constantly. Some never cry in public. Some joke at funerals as coping. Some seem fine for weeks, then collapse months later. There is no right way to grieve, and the absence of visible grief does not equal guilt. Scott Peterson's behavior was suspicious, absolutely, but suspicion is not evidence. Reading someone's intent based on how they act under unimaginable stress, public scrutiny, and police investigation is almost impossible to do accurately. Because people who are guilty act strange, and people who are innocent but terrified they'll be blamed also act strange. From the outside, those two things are indistinguishable.
Real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.
On April 13th, 2003, a couple walking their dog along the rocky shore of San Francisco Bay near Point Isabel in Richmond found the body of a baby boy. The remains were small, partially decomposed. The umbilical cord was still attached. The next day, April 14th, about a mile and a half away, a woman discovered a torso washed up near Brooks Island. The torso was headless, both forearms missing, both legs severed below the knee. The body was so badly decomposed it was nearly unrecognizable. DNA testing confirmed the remains were Lacey Peterson and her unborn son, Connor. The medical examiner could not determine cause of death. No stab wounds, no bullet holes, no obvious trauma. Decomposition was too severe. All they could say definitively was that Lacey had died sometime between December 24, 2002 and when her body was recovered in April 2003. But there was one detail that became the centerpiece of the prosecution's case. The bodies were found in San Francisco Bay, within miles of the Berkeley Marina. The exact location where Scott Peterson said he had been fishing on December 24th. The statistical odds of Lacey's body washing ashore in the exact area where Scott had been that day, by pure coincidence, were astronomically low. The prosecution argued this wasn't coincidence. This was evidence. On April 18th, 2003, Scott Peterson was arrested in La Jolla, California, near the Mexican border. When police pulled him over, he had $15,000 in cash, four cell phones, camping gear, a shovel, rope, knife, double-edged dagger, and duct tape. He had dyed his hair blonde and his goatee reddish-brown. He had his brother's driver's license and four credit cards belonging to family members. He was 30 miles from Mexico. The arrest made headlines worldwide. Scott Peterson was charged with two counts of murder. First degree for Lacey's death, second degree for Connors. The trial began June 1, 2004, in Redwood City, California. It lasted nearly 5 months. The prosecution built its case on 4 main pillars, none involving direct physical evidence tying Scott to the actual act of murder. Pillar 1, motive. The prosecution argued Scott killed Lacey because he didn't want to be a father, didn't want to be tied to a marriage, and saw murder as his escape. He was having an affair with Amber Frey, told her he was single, wanted a future with her, and Lacey, 8 months pregnant, excited about the baby, was standing in the way. Amber testified for multiple days. The jury heard hours of recorded calls, Scott lying, deflecting, spinning elaborate stories. They played the New Year's Eve call where Scott tells Amber he's in Paris while standing at a vigil for Lacey. Calls where Scott talks about his plans for the future with Amber while police search for his missing wife. The affair painted Scott as a liar, a manipulator, and a man willing to do anything to preserve the life he wanted. Pillar 2, opportunity. Scott Peterson was the last person to see Lacey alive. He left that morning. When he came back, she was gone. No one could confirm they'd seen Lacey after 9:30 a.m. The prosecution argued Scott killed Lacey either the night of December 23rd or morning of December 24th, before he left for the marina. They theorized he strangled her, weighted her body with homemade concrete anchors, loaded her into his truck, drove to Berkeley Marina, and dumped her body during his fishing trip. Scott purchased the 14-foot aluminum boat on December 9, 2002, the same day he told Amber he'd lost his wife. He'd never been fishing before, never mentioned wanting a boat. The prosecution argued he bought that boat specifically to dump Lacey's body. Scott had also bought concrete mix in the weeks before Lacey disappeared. He told people he was making anchors for the boat. Police found no completed anchors, but evidence suggested Lacey's body had been weighted down. The decomposition pattern and where the body was found suggested it had been anchored and broken free. And the fact that Lacey's body washed ashore in the exact area where Scott had been fishing? The prosecution brought in oceanographers and tidal experts who testified that based on currents, water temperature, and decomposition rates, Lacey's body had likely been placed in the water near Berkeley Marina sometime around December 24th. Pillar 3, behavior. The prosecution called witness after witness to describe Scott's bizarre behavior after Lacey disappeared. Lacey's mother, Sharon Rocha, testified about how Scott didn't comfort her, didn't seem panicked, didn't act like a man whose wife was missing. She described him as cold, detached, almost irritated by her grief. Friends and neighbors testified about seeing Scott laugh at vigils, check his phone during searches, seem more concerned with media attention than finding Lacey. The prosecution played clips from Scott's media interviews where he spoke about Lacey in past tense, seemed eerily calm, couldn't remember basic details about his fishing trip. And then there was the arrest. The blonde hair, the cash, the proximity to Mexico, the fake IDs. The prosecution argued this was a man preparing to flee the country, to escape justice, to start over somewhere far from consequences. Pillar 4, the bodies. This was the prosecution's strongest argument. Lacey and Connor Peterson washed ashore in San Francisco Bay, within miles of the Berkeley Marina where Scott said he had been fishing on December 24th. Expert witnesses testified about tidal patterns, water currents, and how bodies decompose in salt water. Their conclusion, based on where the bodies were found and their condition, Lacey had likely been placed in the water near Berkeley Marina. If someone else killed Lacey, why would her body end up in the one place Scott Peterson could be definitively placed on the day she disappeared? The defense argued it was coincidence. The prosecution argued coincidences like that don't happen. The defense did what they could. They argued Scott was a loving husband who had nothing to do with Lacey's death. The affair, while morally wrong, didn't prove murder. There was no forensic evidence, no blood, no DNA, no murder weapon, no crime scene. The investigation had tunnel vision from day one. Police focused on Scott so completely they ignored other leads. They tried to introduce the possibility that a burglary across the street from the Petersons' home might be connected to Lacey's disappearance. The prosecution shut it down. The timeline didn't match, they said. The burglary happened on December 26th. Lacey disappeared on the 24th. The jury wasn't allowed to hear more about it. After weeks of testimony and days of deliberation, the jury returned their verdict on November 12, 2004. Guilty on both counts. Scott Peterson was convicted of first-degree murder for Lacey's death and second-degree murder for Connor's death. In March 2005, he was sentenced to death and sent to San Quentin State Prison to await execution. The families of Lacey and Connor wept. America felt justice had been served. Case closed. Or so everyone thought.
Real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.
The prosecution built their case on reading Scott Peterson's intent from his actions. The jury agreed. But intent is only as reliable as our ability to read it. And 20 years later, new evidence suggests we may have misread everything. Scott Peterson was sent to San Quentin's death row. His appeals were filed and systematically denied. The media moved on. The public moved on. Justice had been served. The case was over. But in 2020, something changed. The California Supreme Court overturned Scott Peterson's death sentence, citing errors in jury selection. Specifically, a juror named Rochelle Nice had failed to disclose that she had previously sought a restraining order against her boyfriend's ex-girlfriend while she herself was pregnant. This was critical. A juror who had personal experience with violence while pregnant should have been excluded from a case involving the murder of a pregnant woman. Her presence on the jury may have biased the verdict. Scott was resentenced to life in prison without parole. And then, in January 2024, something extraordinary happened. The Los Angeles Innocence Project announced they were taking on Scott Peterson's case. The LAIP is one of the most respected wrongful conviction organizations in the country. They receive thousands of requests for help every year. They take on maybe 1 to 2% of those cases, only the ones where they see serious, credible, systematic problems with the conviction. They've exonerated dozens of people. They've overturned murder convictions. They've freed people who spent decades in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And now, they were saying Scott Peterson's conviction was flawed. A judge granted the LAIP access to dozens of pieces of previously undisclosed evidence, evidence that had been sitting in police storage for over 20 years, never fully examined, never tested, never presented to a jury. In April 2025, the Los Angeles Innocence Project filed an 854-page petition with the California Court of Appeal. Their central argument, Scott Peterson did not kill Lacey Peterson. Burglars killed her after she confronted them during a robbery across the street. And police knew about this alternative theory and deliberately suppressed it. Let's examine what they found. The timeline problem. The prosecution's entire case rested on one assumption. Lacey died on December 23rd or the morning of December 24th, before Scott left for the marina. This timeline was critical. If Lacey died before Scott left, he was the only person with opportunity. If she died after, someone else killed her. The prosecution based this timeline on fetal development analysis. A forensic pathologist examined Connor's remains and estimated his gestational age based on measurements of his bones and organs. He concluded Connor had likely died around the time Lacey disappeared, late December 2002. But the Los Angeles Innocence Project brought in new experts who used contemporary fetal development research published by the National Institutes of Health, research that wasn't available in 2004. These experts analyzed Connor's measurements using modern, more accurate methods. Their conclusion was startling. Connor's development was consistent with death occurring between December 28th and January 5th, 2003. That's 4 to 12 days after Lacey disappeared. During that window, Scott Peterson had alibis. He was being actively surveilled by police. He was on national television. He was with family members, with investigators, constantly in the public eye. He could not have killed Lacey during that time frame. If this new analysis is correct, if Lacey and Connor died days after December 24th, then Scott didn't kill them. Someone else did. The burglary connection. This is where the case gets explosive. At trial, the defense tried to introduce evidence of a burglary at the home of the Medinas, the Petersons' neighbors directly across the street on Covina Avenue. The prosecution dismissed it. They said the burglary happened on December 26th, 2 days after Lacey disappeared, so it couldn't possibly be connected. The jury never heard the full story. But according to the Los Angeles Innocence Project, the burglary didn't happen on December 26th. It happened on December 24th, the same day Lacey vanished. The LAIP alleges that police knew this and deliberately changed the date in their reports to make it seem like the burglary couldn't be connected to Lacey's disappearance. Here's the evidence they present. Multiple witnesses reported seeing suspicious activity at the Medina house on December 24th. A neighbor, Diane Jackson, saw an orange or tan van parked outside the Medina home. She saw men carrying items out of the house, a safe, electronics, other valuables. Another witness reported hearing men talking in the street. One of them mentioned the pregnant woman who had seen them. Two men, Stephen Todd and Donald Pierce, were eventually arrested and confessed to burglarizing the Medina home. During police interviews, Stephen Todd allegedly said that Lacey Peterson had confronted them. He said she saw them robbing the house. He said she got in their faces about it. He said she was angry, assertive, not backing down. Think about what that means. Lacey Peterson, 8 months pregnant, protective of her neighborhood, someone whose friends described as not afraid to speak up, saw burglars robbing her neighbor's house and confronted them. If burglars committing a felony were confronted by a witness who could identify them, what would they do? They'd panic. They'd need to make sure she couldn't go to the police. They'd need to silence her. That's motive for abduction. That's motive for murder. But this lead was barely investigated. Police interviewed Todd and Pierce about the burglary, got their confessions, and moved on. They never seriously pursued the possibility that these men had killed Lacey. Why? Because they had already decided Scott Peterson was guilty. The Los Angeles Innocence Project alleges that police deliberately suppressed evidence connecting the burglary to Lacey's disappearance. They changed the date in reports. They buried witness statements. They failed to follow up on credible leads. If true, that's not just negligence, that's misconduct. The burned van. On December 28, 2002, 4 days after Lacey disappeared, an orange or tan van was found burning in an alley in Modesto, not far from the Petersons' home. When firefighters extinguished the blaze and searched the van, they found a mattress inside. The mattress appeared to have bloodstains on it. Police photographed the van. They documented the mattress. They opened an investigation into who owned the van and why it had been set on fire. But within days, the investigation was dropped. The van was released to its owner. The mattress was never fully tested for DNA. The blood was never conclusively identified. The Los Angeles Innocence Project alleges that police deliberately failed to investigate this van because it didn't fit their narrative. Think about the timeline. December 24th, Lacey disappears. The Medina burglary occurs. Lacey allegedly confronts the burglars. December 28th. A van matching the description witnesses gave of the vehicle at the Medina house is found burning with a bloody mattress inside. The LAIP's theory. The burglars used this van to transport Lacey after they abducted her. The blood on the mattress could be hers. They burned the van to destroy evidence, but we'll never know for certain because police focused so completely on Scott Peterson that they let this lead disappear. The witnesses who were never heard. Multiple people reported seeing Lacey Peterson alive after Scott left the house on December 24th. A woman walking her dog in La Loma Park said she saw a very pregnant woman matching Lacey's description. wearing light-colored pants and a dark top, walking a golden retriever around 10:30 to 10:45 a.m. This would be after the neighbor found Mackenzie loose at 10:18 a.m., but consistent with Lacey having returned home, secured the dog, and then taken her out for another walk. Another witness reported seeing a pregnant woman matching Lacey's description in a nearby parking lot, appearing distressed, being approached by men in a van. These witnesses came forward during the investigation. They gave statements to police. They were willing to testify, but their accounts were dismissed. Why? Because they contradicted the prosecution's timeline. If Lacey was alive at 10:30 or 10:45 a.m., and Scott had already left for Berkeley by 10 a.m., then he couldn't have killed her. So police buried these witness statements. They were never presented to the jury. They were never seriously investigated. The Los Angeles Innocence Project tracked down these witnesses decades later. Some have died. Some have moved away. But several are still willing to testify about what they saw. Former detectives who worked the case have pushed back, arguing these witnesses were unreliable, that their timelines were inconsistent, that they were mistaken. But the witnesses were never given a chance to be heard by a jury. The duct tape. When Lacey's body was recovered, there was a piece of duct tape attached to her pants near the waistband. The duct tape was logged into evidence, photographed, stored, but it was never tested for DNA. Think about that. For 22 years, a piece of physical evidence that could definitively prove or disprove Scott's involvement sat in an evidence locker untested. In 2024, a judge finally ordered DNA testing on the duct tape. The results haven't been made public yet. Testing is still ongoing. But here's why it matters. If that duct tape contains DNA that doesn't belong to Scott Peterson, that's exculpatory evidence. It proves someone else handled Lacey's body. It proves Scott didn't act alone or didn't act at all. Why wasn't this tested in 2003? Why did it take a wrongful conviction organization's intervention and a court order to get this basic forensic work done? The answer seems clear, because police were so certain that Scott was guilty that they didn't think they needed it. The response from authorities. It's important to note that the California Attorney General's office has pushed back aggressively against the Los Angeles Innocence Project's claims. They've called the theories baseless. They argue that many of the witnesses cited in the petition were inconsistent or unreliable during the original investigation. They say these are recycled arguments that were already considered and rejected during Scott's appeals process. And in 2025, a judge reviewed the 854-page petition and denied many of the 19 claims presented by the LAIP. The case is moving forward on a narrow basis, primarily focused on potential juror misconduct related to Rochelle Nice. So the legal battle is far from over. The courts may ultimately determine that the new evidence isn't compelling enough to overturn the conviction. But here's what we can't ignore. The burglary happened on December 24th, not the 26th. Lacey may have confronted the burglars. A van with a bloody mattress was found burning nearby and wasn't properly investigated. Witnesses said they saw Lacey alive after Scott left and were dismissed. Physical evidence that could exonerate Scott was never tested for over 20 years. Whether or not this evidence is enough to overturn his conviction, it raises serious questions about how this investigation was conducted and whether Scott Peterson received a fair trial. So let's come back to the central question. Intent doesn't lie. That's the foundation of this show. People's intentions are revealed through their actions, not their words. But what if we misread the intent entirely? Scott Peterson acted guilty. There's no disputing that. He lied. He cheated. He seemed emotionless. He sold Lacey's car. He remodeled the nursery. He fled toward Mexico with cash and dyed hair. Every single action screamed guilt. But if Scott didn't kill Lacey, if someone else did, then what was his intent? Not murder. Survival. He was having an affair. When Lacey disappeared, he knew it would come out and make him look guilty. So he lied to Amber. Not because he had killed Lacey, But because admitting I'm married, my pregnant wife just disappeared, and I'm the prime suspect, would end the relationship and make him look worse. His intent? Hide the affair because it was the one thing in his life that felt good while everything else fell apart. He was emotionally shut down. If he was experiencing genuine trauma, from shock or from terror of being the prime suspect, his brain might have shut down emotional responses as survival. His intent? Survive moment to moment without falling apart, because showing emotion in public would make him look more suspicious. He sold Lacey's car and remodeled the nursery. Could be someone who can't bear to look at reminders of what he's lost, trying desperately to function by removing triggers. His intent? Avoid unbearable pain, whether he caused it or someone else did. He fled toward Mexico. By April 2003, Scott's face was on every TV screen. He couldn't leave his house without cameras. He was receiving death threats. His family was being harassed. His intent? Escape the mob, not the law, because he believed he could never get a fair trial. Here's the impossible question. Can we tell the difference between guilt and terror? Between a murderer covering his tracks and an innocent man panicking because everyone thinks he's a murderer? From the outside, they look identical. If Scott killed Lacey, his intent is clear. Murder his wife, dump her body, start a new life, and, when caught, run. If Scott didn't kill Lacey, his intent is equally clear, but completely different. Hide the shameful affair. Survive the trauma of losing his wife. Cope with being the prime suspect. And eventually flee the persecution. Same actions, same behavior. Two completely different interpretations of intent. The prosecution asked the jury to read Scott's mind based on his behavior. And the jury did. They looked at Scott Peterson and saw a murderer. But what if they were wrong? What if they saw guilt where there was only fear? What if they saw calculation where there was only panic? What if they saw a killer where there was only a deeply flawed man making terrible decisions under unimaginable pressure? Intent doesn't lie, but people do. And sometimes, often, our ability to read intent from behavior is catastrophically flawed. Before we close this case, we need to remember who was lost. Lacey Denise Peterson, 27 years old. She loved decorating. She loved cooking. She loved making people feel special. She was the kind of person who remembered your birthday, who showed up when you needed her, who made you feel like you mattered. She was excited about becoming a mother. She had decorated the nursery with ocean themes, wells and sailboats and soft blues and greens. She'd picked out tiny clothes. She'd chosen the name Connor. She'd spent hours imagining what kind of mother she'd be. She was 8 months pregnant when she disappeared, 6 weeks away from holding her son, Connor Peterson, never born. He never took a breath, never opened his eyes, never felt his mother's arms around him. He was stolen before he ever had a chance to exist. He would be 23 years old now. He'd be graduating from college. He'd be starting a career. He'd be living the life his mother dreamed for him. Instead, his body washed ashore in the San Francisco Bay, still connected to his mother by the umbilical cord that should have given him life. Whether Scott Peterson killed them or not, these two lives were stolen. Lacey's family, her mother Sharon, her father Dennis, her brother Brent, her stepfather Ron, have lived with this loss for over 20 years. They've had to watch Scott's appeals. They've had to relive the trial. They've had to see his face on the news again and again, as new evidence is presented and old wounds are reopened. Sharon Rocha has spoken publicly about the pain of not knowing, really knowing, what happened to her daughter. She has stated, "I want to believe justice was served." But there are so many unanswered questions. Lacey and Connor Peterson deserve to be remembered as people, not as a case, not as a media spectacle, not as a legal puzzle. They were real. They mattered. They were loved. And they're gone. The case of Scott Peterson isn't like most cases we cover on Deadly Intent. Usually, we examine cases where guilt is certain, and we analyze the behavioral evidence that proves it. We look at what someone did and what their actions reveal about their intent. But this case is different. This case forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth. Intent doesn't lie, but our ability to read intent from behavior is deeply, fundamentally flawed. We convicted Scott Peterson based on how he looked, how he acted, how we assumed he felt. We had no forensic evidence, no murder weapon, no crime scene, no witness, no confession. What we had was suspicion. And in the American justice system, suspicion, if packaged correctly, presented persuasively, and reinforced by media coverage, can be enough. The Los Angeles Innocence Project has presented evidence that challenges the foundation of Scott's conviction. New scientific analysis that suggests Lacey died days after Scott's alibi. Evidence that a burglary happened the day Lacey disappeared, not 2 days later. Witness statements that Lacey confronted the burglars. A van with a bloody mattress found burning nearby that was never properly investigated. Witnesses who saw Lacey alive after Scott left, whose accounts were dismissed and buried. Physical evidence that was never tested for over 20 years. Does this mean Scott Peterson is innocent? No, not definitively. Does it mean he's guilty? Also, no, not definitively. What it means is that we convicted a man based on how he seemed, not on what we could prove. And that should terrify every single one of us. Because if we got it wrong, if Scott Peterson is innocent, then we've done two unforgivable things. We've imprisoned an innocent man for 20 years, and we've let the real killers of Lacey and Connor Peterson walk free. But here's the question that haunts this case. If Scott didn't kill Lacey, why did he lie? Why the affair he tried so desperately to hide? Why the detachment, the strange behavior, the past tense language? Why sell her car, remodel the nursery, flee toward Mexico? Intent doesn't lie. Scott Peterson intended something when he did those things. If his intent wasn't murder, then what was it? Fear? Shame? Self-preservation? Panic? Or was it exactly what the prosecution said it was? Consciousness of guilt? I've presented the evidence as thoroughly as I can. I've shown you the case against Scott and the cracks in that case. I've analyzed the behavioral evidence and the alternative explanations. You've heard the facts. You can draw your own conclusions. But three things are certain. Lacey Peterson is dead. Connor Peterson never got to be born. And somewhere, whether in a prison cell or walking free, someone knows the truth about what happened on December 24th, 2002. Intent doesn't lie. People do. And sometimes our certainty does too. Scott Peterson remains in Mule Creek State Prison, serving life without the possibility of parole. The Los Angeles Innocence Project is still fighting for a new trial. DNA testing on the duct tape is ongoing, and the truth of what happened to Lacey and Connor Peterson is still waiting to be found. Whether we'll ever find it is another question entirely. I'm Carmen Carrion, and this has been Deadly Intent. If this case makes you uncomfortable, that's the point. It should make you uncomfortable, because it forces us to ask the hardest questions about justice, about certainty, and about what happens when we convict someone based on who we think they are, instead of what we can prove they did. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, please reach out for help. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-7233 or visit thehotline.org. If you're in immediate danger, call 911. Next time on Deadly Intent, a passionate romance that turned into a nightmare, a brutal murder scene that shocked investigators, and a defendant who couldn't keep her story straight. Travis Alexander was found dead in his Mesa, Arizona home, stabbed 29 times, his throat slashed, and a gunshot wound to the head. His ex-girlfriend, Jody Arias, claimed self-defense. Then she claimed she wasn't there. Then she changed her story again. The trial became a media circus, with Jody giving 18 days of testimony, spinning tales of abuse, memory loss, and fear. But the evidence told a different story. The photographs, the timeline, the lies that kept shifting. This is a case about obsession, control, and what happens when rejection turns deadly. Jodi Arias, the woman who couldn't stop talking and couldn't stop lying. Thanks for listening to Deadly Intent. If this episode got you thinking, hit subscribe so you don't miss what's coming next. Leave a review if you're feeling generous. It helps more people find the show. Until then, remember, intent doesn't lie. People do. I'm Carmen, and this is Deadly Intent.
Real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.